You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a show that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Tina Grandinetti, and I'll be your humble host and fellow traveler on this Huaka'i to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, and people that sustain us. One night in November of 2020, I drove down to Kalailoa, parked down a random street, and joined a group of 200 or 300 people who'd been gathering night after night for weeks, putting their bodies on the line to stop the transport of equipment from Kalailoa to Kahuku for the construction of the AES industrial wind farm. I was there to work on the legal observer team. I documented police interactions with Kia'i because in the month prior, police had arrested nearly 200 Kia'i and had been accused of using excessive force on peaceful protectors. That night, I was posted against a police barricade where I watched as Kahuku Kia'i chained themselves together with chicken wire and PVC pipe to block the road. I winced as police used electric saws to cut through pipe so close to skin. I watched as they carried kupuna into paddy wagons and ignored their cries and their chants. The ordeal lasted into the early hours of the morning, so long that the window for transporting that massive equipment on the freeway was almost closed, and the Kia'i were so close. So with time running out and just one protector left chained to the road, I saw HPD press her body up against the barricade, huddle around her in this semicircle as this huge truck squeezed past carrying tons of just like unimaginably huge equipment just inches from her body without her consent and at great risk to her safety. In the crowd, I could feel this collective sense of rage, shock, and super deep sadness. A man next to me screamed, and then everyone started shouting, "Heva, heva." It was just so wrong, and I was in disbelief because here was this working class rural community made up largely of Kanaka Maoli and Pacific Islanders saying loud and clear that they did not want an industrial project constructed so close to their homes and schools. And in response, HPD had risked a woman's safety for the benefit of a private corporation. We're used to fossil fuels being the culprit in this kind of story. A pipeline or a fracking station or a coal mine being forced upon a community at the expense of their health, of their connection to their land, and of the overall health of our planet. This is a story that's typical of the destructive impacts of the intersections between capitalism, colonization, and fossil fuels that have historically meant that our energy resources have been extracted from the earth at the cost of poor, Black, Indigenous, and POC communities, while multinational corporations reap unimaginable profits. But in recent years, we've begun this kind of stop and start shift towards renewable energy. Hawaii, for example, has a goal of reaching 100% renewables by 2045. It sounds great, but Kalailoa makes me wonder, what does it mean for our future when this shift is being led by the same powerful corporations that have dominated our energy landscape for generations, the same people who got us into this mess? Is green energy or renewable energy or clean energy always good with a capital G? Is it really that simple? If you're listening to this podcast, you can probably guess that the answer is no. Switching to renewables will not address the inequalities that were baked into our energy system from its very beginnings. So this season, on Root Cause Remedies, we're digging into energy justice in Hawaii and asking how we can move closer towards the goal of achieving equity in both social and economic participation in the energy system, while also remediating social, economic, and health burdens on those who've been historically harmed by the energy system. Energy justice, like climate justice and environmental justice, demands ending corporate control of our resources and creating a future defined by self-determination and equity. In this episode, we're tackling the Hawaiian Electric Company because we can't talk about energy in Hawaii without talking about the monopoly that Hawaiian Electric has had over it since the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Then we'll dig into what this history means for our understanding of energy justice and how we can achieve it here at home. And you're in for a treat because joining me this week is Lauren Ballesteros Watanabe, who is actually the person who dreamed up this podcast and kind of makes it happen. Lauren is a third generation working class Chicana and poet from East Los Angeles, and she currently lives here in Honolulu, where she works as the Sierra Club of Hawaii's organizer. And as you can tell from this podcast, she has a passion for social justice and for storytelling, and specifically the kinds of storytelling that fuels us and fuels movements. She's amazing. I love her. I don't know if she loves me because she always has to wrangle me back into shape when I let this podcast fall to the back burner. So really, you have her to thank for all of it. Okay, so let's just get started. So in your role organizing with Sierra Club Hawaii, you've been working super hard on energy justice. And I know from our many podcast conversations that the biggest obstacle in that journey has been Hawaiian Electric, which supplies power to 95% of Hawaii's population. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes this corporation so powerful and so problematic?
Yeah, I'd love to. Like you said, Hawaiian Electric supplies 95% of Hawaii's power because we have a centralized power grid. They control it and own most of the infrastructure. Here on Oahu, we're used to referring to it as HECO, but whether you say Hawaiian Electric, MIKO on Maui, HELCO on Hawaii Island, it's all the same entity owned by Hawaiian Electric Industries. And the company is a private investor-owned utility with some of the largest equity firms in the world. And this is problematic because much of Hawaiian Electric's decision-making is about profit maximization for shareholders, disconnected from the consequences of these decisions. And since its inception, Hawaiian Electric has been problematic and deeply intertwined with our economic, political, and social history. It has been a violent injustice since its beginnings in the Kingdom era.
Okay, that was news to me. I had no idea that Hawaiian Electric was that old, first of all, and that it had such kind of like insidious roots until I read an article you wrote called How Hawaiian Electric Powered the Overthrow.
Yeah. It's crazy. And the history is so important. The roots are critical to understanding what we are experiencing today. And I am by no means a scholar in Hawaiian history, so I'll just say that. But in my research, I did find eye-opening info. This story kind of starts in 1881 with King Kalakaua, who was really fascinating. A couple things. He signed treaties with the U.S., but then attempted to strengthen ties with countries that he hoped would protect Hawaii from being annexed. He was doing all this work to reintroduce traditional culture and customs in Hawaii, but he also loved the techie stuff and was infatuated by the future. So he set out on a global tour. And when he arrived in Paris, the International Exposition of Electricity was showcasing the latest advancements in electric technology. So it was a big deal. And soon after that, he met Thomas Edison himself in New York City. They discussed not only the technicalities of generating electric lights, but also the business of selling power. And from that meeting came a whirlwind of homegrown efforts to successfully generate electricity throughout the Hawaiian Islands. So on July 21st, 1886, an insurance executive from the continental U.S., organized a demonstration of electric lights at Iolani Palace. Interestingly, Iolani Palace was not the first demonstration. That goes to Maui plantation owner Klaus Breckels in 1881. And I mention this because his innovation came from his desire for his workers to process sugarcane around the clock, thus avoiding the expense of any downtime during peak season. But for Iolani Palace to be lit was a big deal because at that scale, electrification sparked investments in new technology and carved a path for new enterprise.
Yeah, that's kind of one of Hawaii's claims to fame, that the Iolani Palace had electricity even before the White House, because it's kind of like a reminder that the independent Hawaiian kingdom was forward-thinking and innovative in spite of all these racist ideas that might tell us otherwise.
Yeah, so with the palace being lit, King Kalakaua wanted to power the streets of Honolulu. He and a handful of key government officials went up to Nu'uana Valley to test whether stream water could generate electricity. By 1888, Princess Kaiulani used hydropower to light electric street lamps in Honolulu, which is really cool that the first illumination of a public space in Hawaii came from a renewable source.
That is really cool. Okay, so where does Hawaiian Electric come into play?
Well, at the same time of electrification happening on the islands, wealthy white businessmen, mostly from the continental U.S., saw big financial opportunities. So the creation of Hawaiian Electric itself coincided with the last days of the ruling royals, and it wasn't coincidental. In 1887, a militia of white men organized an armed insurrection to force King Kalakaua to sign a new constitution at 2 a.m. that would make some of those insurrectionist cabinet members and requiring substantial land ownership to voting rights. It became known as a bayonet constitution.
Right. Professor Hioli Osorio talked about that in season one, and I think even Kyle Kajihiro, the bayonet constitution gave foreigners, specifically white land-owning foreigners, surprise, surprise, gave them power to get away from Native Hawaiians.
Exactly. And so that really marked the beginning of the end for Hawaiian independence because it reduced the monarchy's power to essentially a figurehead. And one of the men there from the beginning was William Hall, a wealthy scion of a missionary turned merchant family. He was a part of the missionary party that formed a secret society called the Hawaiian League, aka the insurrectionists. He was also one of the four partners that preceded Hawaiian Electric. When the partnership dissolved and Hawaiian Electric was incorporated in 1891, Hall became its first president the same year that King Kalakaua died.
Damn, it's that convergence of power and money and white supremacy.
And it gets worse. Fast forward to 1893, 5 days before the overthrow, Queen Liliuokalani signed a law that gave the government the power to sell an exclusive 10-year franchise to a company to provide electric light and power in Honolulu. She was so wise that the sale actually came with regulations, including limiting how much the winning bidder could charge and requirements to be audited by authorities. And 2 days after the utility deal was announced, the Queen declared that she had written a new constitution for Hawaii that would restore many voting rights for Native Hawaiians and re-energize the power of the throne.
That's so cool. She was regulating capital and trying to strengthen the law of Hawaii and take back power for her people.
Yep, but the white business elite weren't having it. 3 days after that new constitution was declared, a group of them, including three of Hawaiian Electric's five leaders, responded by overthrowing the Queen.
Three out of five. I genuinely had no idea.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't. And what's worse is that William Hall was also a quartermaster in the kingdom's National Guard. So it was his job to ensure that martial law was maintained the days following the coup. So when the time came to bid for the 10-year franchise, Hall made his pitch and there were no other bids. So Hall's utility became the energy provider for the country that he had helped to overthrow. Now, over a century later, Hawaiian Electric has grown into one of the most important and influential businesses in Hawaii.
That story is so wild. It's always so disturbing to me when you have a second to reflect on how so many of the culprits of the overthrow still have so much power and money in Hawaii that they stole from Kanaka and at the price of an independent Hawaiian nation. It's infuriating. But let's talk about what they've done with that power and how it impacts us today.
Yeah, well, as Hawaiian Electric's infrastructure expanded, it really steered the geographic development of communities and commercial districts. So that's why their political power has been arguably unrivaled for much of the last century.
And one really important thing to keep in mind is that Hawaiian Electric encompasses multiple entities. They have their tentacles in so many areas of our energy system and our political system because they run the centralized power grid for all of the state. And originally, I also learned from you that the creation of that centralized power grid was meant to provide equal access for all residents.
Yeah, it's so ironic because What happened was it ended up getting perverted by corporate and monopoly power because its business model is to maximize profits to shareholders.
Yep, profit over people. So who specifically is profiting?
Their major shareholders are private equity investment firms, including BlackRock, with over $7 trillion in global assets. These financial institutions are not in the business of producing electricity. Their entire business design is to make money. So Hawaiian Electric even owns their own bank, American Savings, if anyone has that bank. And at the end of the day, Hawaii is just a portfolio piece. And that at its core is unjust. That is what we mean about ending the top-down approach to our energy system. Those at the top only see numbers, data, dollar signs. It's dehumanized and comes at the cost of everyone else. Our quality of life and the rights of the land. But this is a common story with corporations and private investor-owned models at the center of many injustices that we've talked about so far on our podcast.
Okay, so this local issue also really hooks us into these international circuits of capital. But closer to home, our listeners might recognize the name Alan Oshima because he was the president of HECO. And he actually stepped down to be appointed by Governor Ige as the head of the Hawaii Economic and Community Recovery and Resiliency Team, which was formed to address the impacts of COVID-19, which I thought was really disappointing for such a corporate guy to be shaping our post-COVID economy, because someone who benefited from the previous economy is going to try to build a new one that looks like the original, but we need something different. And they want to keep benefiting from the status quo.
That is so true. And yeah, thank you for saying that. And just to put into perspective, he was really benefiting. In 2018, he made $2.8 million, including bonuses. But again, that is the business model. CEOs are supposed to do everything in their power to increase profits to shareholders and get compensated well for it.
Yeah, I think Alan Oshima's appointment is also a really important example of not just the economic power, but also the political power that Hawaiian Electric has in Hawaii.
Yeah, I will just add that the current CEO makes 18 times more than the median salary at Hawaiian Electric, actually already at six figures per year. So imagine how much more the CEO makes than the women and men doing the actual work to put up the power lines.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's not even like, that's not compared to the median salary of like the average worker in Hawaii.
Exactly.
But on that point, how does Hawaiian Electric treat their workers?
Well, corporate run businesses tend to always have the same mode of operation. Cut your costs, increase profit. But fortunately, many of their employees are actually unionized, from customer service to power line construction. And because of that, these workers have family sustaining good wages with pension and benefits. But Hawaiian Electric has been known to subcontract workers from a third party, even flying them in from the mainland, which is a common practice and a tactic to undermine union labor and actually gives them an out when the project is fought. And just like in the Napuamakoni turbines in Kahuku, that construction was done through subcontracted labor. But to really hit the point of their actions, but recently, Hawaiian Electric's 2020 report, they stated that HECO saw a net income of $169 million, which was an increase from the year prior. And they actually said that it was from cutting operation costs and layoffs were included in that. But why, if they weren't losing money? And even worse than that is that they were still giving out bonuses during the pandemic to their executives. And that added up to about $2 million. If they would have forgone that, they could have kept workers who need the income, or we estimated that those bonuses could have actually gone to bill forgiveness for over 14,000 bills from households that are struggling due to the pandemic. So these actions really show their true colors in our times of crisis and times of need. And as an essential service provider, it is so critical that we hold them accountable for providing this service and having the privilege to service 95% of our population.
Okay, let's pivot a bit. Can you tell us about how Hawaiian Electric's monopoly power has been an obstacle
in the transition away from fossil fuels, because I feel like their branding would probably tell us otherwise.
Oh yeah. There is a whole lot to unpack, but in a nutshell, I like to call them energy transition sloths. In 2015, the state made its goal to be powered by 100% renewables by 2045. That meant that Hawaiian Electric was supposed to pivot completely away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. But here we are 6 years later from that, with over 60% fossil fuel derived energy, imported oil and coal. Luckily, last year, we worked along with other community members coalition to pass a bill at the state legislature to ban the use of coal, to mandate the coal plant to shut down by 2023. But in years prior, Hawaiian Electric would actually lobby against shutting down the coal plant because it produces so much energy. The PUC had an info briefing with Hawaiian Electric on their transition plan from coal, and the PUC basically scolded them for not having a clear plan and delaying renewable projects to replace coal. From our perspective, they are delaying because they are making big money on cheap fossil fuels. They made record profits in 2020, more than they have in previous years.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so how does HECO actually make its money?
It's all messed up. So because electricity is an essential service, it is literally set up so that the utility company never fails. They are able to pass down their cost to customers so that they can continue to provide that service. For example, when imported oil prices go up, they pass that on through their rates. But when oil is cheap, like it is right now, they don't pass on cost savings to customers. Right now, residents are paying 214% higher for electricity than the national average. And it's a continued burden and inequity that is felt deeper during the pandemic. Meanwhile, Hawaiian Electric still makes profits because they're essential. Actually, energy is essential and a human right. So we are at odds with the current private investor-owned system. But the good news, if there is some to share, is that in 2018, Hawaii did pass the Hawaii Ratepayer Protection Act into law, which establishes incentives for the electric utility to provide cheaper renewable energy to its customers. It is a step towards holding utility accountable for providing affordable, clean energy to our community. They talk about doing more performance-based rates, and the act is currently in front of the Public Utilities Commission for implementation, but unfortunately, it's yet to come into fruition. So these changes are really slow, and that's bureaucracy for you.
I know. And it's like, you hear about a good bill and you have to celebrate it. You have to celebrate an achievement like that. But then you're just like, do it together. Can you share about what the Public Utilities Commission is and what it does?
The Public Utilities Commission, we've referred to a lot as the PUC, is the regulating body overseeing Hawaiian Electric and other utilities statewide. It is composed of three commissioners appointed by the governor, whose primary duty is to protect the public interest and ensure that they provide reliable service at just and reasonable rates.
Sounds like those three people have power.
And it's a whole other critical history lesson too, but I'll keep this one brief. It was established in 1913 with five part-time commissioners, two from Oahu and three from neighboring counties. They did extensive work producing a series of investigative reports, held public meetings, pointed out improper practices and charges, even handling complaints and safety investigations. But flash forward to statehood, the state of Hawaii significantly decreased the commission's autonomy. And in the late 70s, the effectiveness further declined. It downsized from five part-time to the three full-time commissioners we have today. And they still hold, you know, public meetings technically, but it rarely happens. The public maybe can comment on a specific docket, but yeah. It rarely happens.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me because even though we're all impacted by energy policy, I don't really think that most people feel empowered or informed enough to participate in something like that because it can be intimidating and you're like kind of made to feel like you don't have anything of value to contribute to that conversation.
Exactly, yeah. And it's because like we think of, or prior, we're thinking of energy as like a technical issue and very, as say, like wonky and scientific. But you know, just to give an example, you know, of the intimidation you would see there is that Hawaiian Electric is notorious for coming to these proceedings with a battalion of lawyers and maybe one community advocate, or, you know, against one like community. The system itself is set up so people don't engage in it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I remember that when the Napua Makani PUC proceedings were happening, the whole room is packed with kia'i and members of the community, but it was horrible because they stopped letting people in and the atmosphere wasn't friendly to the community.
Exactly. And in my work, we're trying to do within energy justice, I would love to change that dynamic. One of the primary goals is getting more people to participate in these PUC proceedings, because that is where the rubber hits the road on our energy system. And yes, it's boring, but it's hella important. And we can't let that be a veiled space for quote unquote experts or industry to make these decisions that impact all of us. Napu Makani taught us lessons on so many fronts why a just transition is critical for an overhaul.
Are there any signs that this kind of participation is effective in actually changing things? Like if you do show up and if you push through, that you actually can change things?
I think so, you know, because there have been recent efforts from the state and the PUC to deconstruct the profit-driven system through the century-old regulatory law. But at this point, in 2021, we can't afford to keep delaying. The PUC exists because the utility doesn't operate by altruistic goals. Because if they wanted to, Hawaiian Electric has the resources, you know, has the financial assets to make all the changes needed, but they don't. And we can't afford to allow them to not have a clear plan. The other thing is that we definitely have energy justice allies working on the inside. So that gives me a lot of hope in fixing the broken system. But we need everyday people engaging and making demands to make it happen sooner and be active participants in the energy transition.
Which is why we're talking about your mission this season.
Yes!
So what do you mean? What do you mean when you use that term?
Okay. Energy justice is defined in different ways. Yeah. So I'll say that energy justice is the convergence of the environmental justice fight against the corporate and government exploitation of BIPOC and working class communities that has defined our relationship to energy. It makes sense, right? Because our current energy system has been shaped according to the needs of capitalism. It has extracted resources from our planet and our communities in order to fuel the capitalist machine. That's happening at a global scale, but also right here in Hawaii, and like we've seen in Kahuku with the wind farm, the same kinds of exploitation that defined our relationships to fossil fuels are being replicated in our relationship to renewable energy.
So, as usual, a lot of this stuff is new to me, and you introduced me to the work of one of the leaders in the energy justice movement, a queer Black woman named Shalonda yes. Baker. And she broke down energy justice into two parts that kind of helped me to like think through it a little. There's process and distribution. First is process, and it tells us that energy justice demands that we look at the process that goes into energy decisions. And the fact of the matter is that these processes are super exclusionary. Decisions that impact the future of our planet are being made by a tiny portion of the 1%. Tiny portion. And energy, something we interact with every day, all day, is turned into this thing that is actually completely out of our control. And not only that, but it's made into something, like you said, really technocratic and framed in such a boring and inaccessible way. And like for me, it was really hard to understand energy as a site of struggle until stuff like Standing Rock and Kahuku brought it into my political consciousness. And I think that's because our current energy system is built on these huge utility scale projects tied to capital gains and profits for these massive corporations instead of smaller scale, decentralized, community-based energy production that works from the needs of our families mm-hmm. and our smaller communities. So maybe part of the paradigm shift has to be that we go from top-down decision-making that's meant to produce profit to bottom-up decision-making where communities have agency in shaping their energy futures. And then Shalonda Baker calls this, I mean, I'm sure not just her, calls it energy democracy. And, like, we have to remember that there are successful alternatives that look like energy democracy happening around the world. But we should learn from our conversation about Hawaiian Electric that energy democracy and corporate energy are really
exactly. Important. Yes, yes. They will always be at odds. And you say things so beautifully. I just want to say that. But another core issue is the lack of community involvement in the development process. And that's not just for energy. That's all development. And so Shalonda calls this procedural justice. These are concerns, who is at the decision-making table and whether once at that table, everyone's voice is heard. Currently, how it works is that a developer makes a plan, gets their permits, contracts, and investments all done before they approach the community about the project, telling the community what is going to happen. It's like Kyle Kajihiro mentioned in our first episode, it's the check the box kind of thing developers do because they have to. Yep. So if the community has concerns or doesn't want the project, it's already too late because those developers rely on their contract rights. Not much the community can do at that point. And, you know, it's inherently unjust. It's also immoral. And why we are trying to build a system that works through community consent. So a developer must bring impacted residents to the decision-making table from the get-go. If they don't get consent, they don't get approved for their project from the county or state government.
That's actually such a tough thing to talk about because community involvement has been so watered down and it's like a corporate performance that I forget how radically different meaningful community involvement would actually look. Because when it's something as exclusionary as energy, you would have to educate the community about energy production and all of its impacts and then talk about all the alternatives and get people informed and empowered enough to take agency. So it's actually really massive.
Yeah. And takes time. I will just say, yeah, I think one of our guest speakers will be able to speak to that a little more because they have been doing that work with communities. Like that's been the goal, you know, definitely I'm not the only person who's done this work or is trying to do this work. But I also want to add that many everyday people, you, me, our friends, our family are now recognizing, you know, these are the silver linings of like the pandemic, how unsustainable our current system is. And that's not just for project development, but it's the corporate model itself is at the center of so many injustices, like even thinking about how our governments respond to the pandemic or cannot.
Yeah.
Just thinking about like medical care has been hijacked by, again, capitalist interests. So the corporate model itself is what we need to just go completely away from. And I read this article that came out last year called The End of the Corporation. It was by a woman from the Democracy Collective. Her name is Marjorie Kelly. And she has done some really great work on the soulless industry that is investment banking and corporate structures, as well as alternative enterprises like cooperatives, public banks, social enterprises, publicly owned corporations, etc. What she wrote, and I'm quoting her here, is as long as the structural forces of current corporate ownership remain in place, where only shareholders vote for the board, where shareholders predominantly the wealthy, where companies define success as a rising share price and pay executives handsomely for achieving it, there's no amount of rhetoric or external regulation that can turn companies away from their existing mandate to create more wealth for the wealthy with all possible speed. The time is coming when society must end the corporation as we know it.
I want that. Mm-hmm. I want that. But okay. So the second element of energy justice is distribution. And Shalonda Baker defines that as ensuring fair and equitable distribution of the benefits and burdens of energy production activities. And this is a huge issue because all around the world, we've seen poor people, people of color, Black, and especially Indigenous communities being forced to bear all the burdens of energy production without reaping their share of the benefit. And then it's happening again, even as we transition away from fossil fuels.
So here in Hawaii, rural working class communities of color are targeted for these huge renewable energy projects where most of the energy gets funneled off to another part of the island or a neighboring one or directly to feed the military's huge energy usage footprint. And that's the centralized grid for you. And meanwhile, low income communities haven't gotten to see the benefits of renewable energy. For example, Hawaiian Electric has this community-based renewable energy program. Its goal is to provide cost savings to low income communities, but it's off to a really slow start. Again, energy sloths, and it's community opposed. It was approved in 2015, but there have only been two CBRE programs in the works. One is Ho'ahu on Molokai and in Wahiwa. The Wahiwa project is already being opposed by the community for being cited for prime ag lands. You know, we have food security as another issue. So the community being wedged into, do we want food or do we want energy, or putting that on the community when it's really the ownership is on the utility and how they're citing, again, it's their choice and how they're identifying these things. There are alternatives. Molokai has this incredible cooperative, which is like, you know, a North Star model of locally sourced, community-owned utility. They've engaged and worked with the community from the very beginning. Hawaiian Electric, though, is actually undermining their efforts with this self-build team and competing directly with the co-op. And the rub of it all, however you want to say it, is that Hawaiian Electric themselves decide who wins that bid. It's ridiculous.
That sounds, I mean, like, I'm even there about, like, this, that's a product of their own program, but then they're undermining that. Thankfully, thanks to you, we are actually having some folks from Molokai share about Ho'ahu, so that'll be exciting.
Yeah, and, you know, they can give a lot more to the incredible efforts they've done and the process they've gone through, that are currently going through. So yes, these stories are incredibly important to recognize, because you mentioned earlier we're seeing the same injustices from, like, the dirty energy system, the same environmental racism is happening, and community members and advocates, actually all of us, should question every project, because time again, the core issue is lack of community in decision making. And that comes at a high cost for the community's quality of life, the environment and native species. And again, I'm excited that we will actually have community members speaking on their own experiences in this all too.
And since we're going over terms, we should also go over the difference between clean and renewable energy.
Yeah. And that's something I didn't even really realize for a long time. And now recognizing that it is actually really critical to distinguish these two, because small wording issue can actually have major implications on our policies and our decarbonization efforts. So in the simplest way to say it, and for our purposes, the difference boils down to this. Clean is energy derived from zero or minimal greenhouse gas emissions like solar, hydro, and wind power. For example, solar is a major source of clean energy that emits zero emissions in production. And why we say minimal is because technically the construction and transportation of solar materials does include emissions, but it's almost not worth nitpicking when in comparison to a coal plant. And as you mentioned, nothing is perfect. Even hydropower, we've seen, can be problematic, because we've seen examples of diverting waterways and disrupting ecosystems. So we have to be honest about those impacts in order to make informed and justice-centered decisions. Now, renewable energy comes from sources that are naturally replenishing, but flow is limited. So like biomass or waste to energy. Now that I know the difference, I'm aware of the politics behind these definitions, actually. In Hawaii, for example, we get some of our energy from burning trash, and that is included in the state's renewable portfolio standard. So that's all the projects considered. Again, this it's a definition. And despite the fact that burning trash produces tons of hazardous pollutants and emissions. But again, that's not coincidental. That's lobbying.
Yeah. Sounds like greenwashing. Like when you call it waste to energy and frame it as part of like a circular economy, it actually doesn't sound that bad. Sounds kind of good.
Oh, yeah. They're so good at that. That's exactly what lobbyists and industries will tell you. And this really undermines our broader goals to reduce our waste, especially fossil fuel derived plastics from entering the waste stream and creating tons of pollution. And then we have biomass, which is burning trees and considered a renewable resource by the same standards, but another contradiction. We need to plant more trees to capture carbon, not burn them for energy.
Yeah, it kind of sucks because you always want to look for an easy answer to these problems. But the system we live in has been so sick and so distorted for so long that it's just impossible to find something that can cut. That word clean again. So to counter that, I guess the point is that we need people equipped with these differences to engage and intervene in these systems to change them to work in a more harmonious way for our well-being and the health of our ecosystems, because it's so entrenched in our society that coming up with alternatives is going to be a difficult process, but it's also going to have really far-reaching consequences if we do it right. And that's why I was involved in the movement for the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy, often frame energy justice and energy equity and energy democracy as part of this broader just transition to a low carbon regenerative economy that will hopefully remedy the injustices of the fossil fuel energy system and the extractive economy.
Thank you for saying that, because I think one real like hopeful way to think about it is that the transition is happening. It has to happen. Hawaiian Electric has to switch their total operation. And so that is the hope. And I guess the goal of energy justice is that if we know that just switching to renewable not address the inherent inequities in our systems, the injustices in our systems, it won't. But if we're intentional, it could, right? If we are engaging, like you're saying.
Yeah.
And so I try to work off of like hope and love.
Yeah. Like it's not guaranteed unless we fight for it, but we can fight.
Exactly. For it. Yeah. And one thing that gets under my skin is that currently in my experience, what I've seen in like the advocacy work at the state and at the county is that everyday people have to fight tooth and nail to be heard or taken seriously by decision makers or by our legislators. And ultimately, all we are doing is trying to protect and preserve our right to a dignified quality of life. And somehow that is not enough. You know, politicians often make decisions based off of narratives coming from the industry, quote unquote, experts, developers, you know, chamber of commerce, business people, private interests. And all of them have financial gains and losses. That's their skin in the game, right? And so their advocacy is not coming from any kind of morality or ideological perspective. No, they're protecting and preserving their business's well-being. It is what it is. So that's what, you know, we talk about, like, that is the model that has to change or we will always be at odds. Because the current worldview of capitalist gains is pay stockholders as much as possible and workers as little as possible. That's a successful business model for them at the detriment of everyone else. I'm good at these mouthfuls, but you know, I think that's, you know, again, important to think about these larger issues or how it's intersecting again with the different, you know, it's just not in the energy sector, but these models operate elsewhere. I know, to put it concisely into perspective, this is why reform won't cut it. We need transformative change, or like how we talked about in seasons prior, decolonization and abolition are the pathways to a better future where everyone benefits and is cared for. That is, like you mentioned, is what a just transition looks like. A system changed from extraction, domination, and control to regenerative compassion and holistic care.
Actually, I just wanted to jump in to something that you said, which was all we're trying to do is protect our right to a dignified quality of life. And that is just, it's so true. And it is this reminder that we need this transformative change to our political system and our economic system, because what we're asking for actually shouldn't be this hard.
Yeah.
We're asking for pretty simple things. And the only reason it's so difficult is because it would stop these people from profiting and it would upset the status quo that benefits them. Mm-hmm. So like we're left with no other choice. Like we wouldn't want to have to do all of the work to like fight for completely transformative change, but we have to, because our relatively simple demands cannot be met by the current system at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, this is where expanding into like how our culture operates or our systems of governance have to come at the community level, because community wants and needs, right? The community impacted, because the trust is they will always do what's best for their fellow neighbor, for themselves, their community and their local environment. Whereas that disconnect at the very top, it just cannot. They're not at the ground level. It's like corporations, again, the CEOs make these decisions and lay off workers and they don't do the job. It's like it ties to so many bigger things, and we shouldn't have to live a life where we're fighting. But that's what we've always done. That's what our ancestors have always done. And now we're at this point of like
time is running out. Like we got to do this now for us and our children, our future children and their children. It's like we don't have a choice anymore.
Yeah. And this is why, you know, once you're aware of one injustice or how it intersects with others, you see it everywhere. And it's with climate change. For a long time, it was on the back burner. Or unfortunately for some of our legislators, or again, these business interests, because they are able to put it off, they're not impacted. But climate change is here. And we're definitely experiencing it here in Hawaii. Yeah. So I think it's like you said, time is running out. And I think one thing of this whole transition, if it's not soulful, it's not strategic, people have to see beauty in this transition, not it just being about fight and scarcity and again, living a life that we deserve, thriving in our future. And that is totally possible. At my heart, I always believe in people power and just holding on to a strong collective vision while actively opposing the existing system and rebuilding our own at the community level. That is completely possible. And one thing that I'll leave you with our listeners with, that I hold on to, is the fact that energy is considered part of the public trust, which like land and water, it is within the public interest to protect these resources, but also to make them accessible. So we should treat energy the same way as we treat water and land, and do everything we can to disallow the privatization and profitization of our natural resources. That is essentially a human right. And one analogy I like to use when it comes to renewable or clean energy, solar, water, it's like bottled water companies. They're not making water. They're just been extracting and filtering natural waters and selling it back to us. That doesn't make sense. Those kind of things that once you think in perspective, it's like, why? No, let's say no to this. Let's build an alternative. And we'll talk about those in our future episodes, which I'm really stoked on. Solutions, not just being always about the problem.
Yeah, the solutions and the people who are fighting through love for their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like sometimes we talk about it as a fight, but once you start talking to organizers and Kia'i and people on the ground, you realize like we don't mean fight as in violence. Like we mean fight as in we love our family and our communities and our lands and waters, and we're willing to put in work to protect them. But thank you so much for joining us today, Lauren. That was so nice to get to hear you talk about like everything you've been working so hard on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Lauren. Listening back to that conversation, one thing that we wanted to emphasize is the point Lauren made about how energy is a part of the public trust in Hawaii. That's super critical, and it's actually something that's unique to Hawaii because it's enshrined in our state constitution. Article 9 explicitly states, "For the benefit of present and future generations, the state shall conserve and protect Hawaii's natural beauty and all natural resources, including land, water, air, minerals, and energy sources, and shall promote the development and utilization of these resources in a manner consistent with their conservation and in furtherance of the self-sufficiency of the state. All public natural resources are held in trust by the state for the benefit of the people. When something's in the public trust, it means that the state has an obligation to ensure that it works for the well-being of all of us. That's obviously open for interpretation. It's a super vague statement, but it's still a powerful one because it's a reminder that our energy doesn't belong to a single corporation, no matter how strong that corporation's monopoly might be. It's meant to serve us, and we should demand that it does. So this season, we'll be hearing directly from folks in Hawaii who are taking on that responsibility. Our conversations will highlight ways we can realize this vision through meaningful community engagement, deep democracy, and having the guts to say, you know what, I do have something to say about Hawaii's energy future. Thanks for listening. Stay rooted.